Welcome to episode 21, the final episode of South Coast, a shaman's tale from the golden age of the solar clipper. Written and read by Nathan Lowell. Chapter 45, Calum's Cove, September 27, 2305. Rachel smiled as Otto straightened up and arched his back to stretch out the muscles. A summer's worth of teenage growth spurt had left him hanging out of his clothes in odd places, and months of hefting heavy crab pots had added bulk to what would otherwise have been a gangly frame. A trick of the angle and the light made him look for just a tick like Richard, and she sighed. "He'll be home soon," Otto said with a smile. The uncanny empathy had only gotten more pronounced as the summer wore on. Of course, she thought to herself, it probably doesn't take a mind reader to see her miss him, and she chuckled. "I know. It's just been a long summer." He smiled and checked the pot once more and flipped it expertly off the stern. While he straightened out the filled boxes, Rachel slipped the boat into gear and headed for the next and last buoy for the day. Mary had been insistent that Rachel fish all the traps. She'd held out until the middle of June, fishing only 50, 25 in the harbor and 25 outside in the open water. The catches were generally pretty astonishing. They kept careful records on the day's landings and had been consistently averaging 12 to 15 kilograms per trap, bringing in over a half a ton a day with 50 traps and well over a ton a day with 100. It took them about 3 hours to fish the 100 traps, so theoretically they could probably manage 200 or even 300 traps a day. She giggled a little, considering how much of a load the boat would have with 300 traps. It was rated at 5 tons, and it would probably need all of it. She got the boat lined up on the last buoy and cut the engines back as Otto snagged it with the gaff. As he worked to haul up the heavy crab pot, she thought that 200 traps would be quite enough load for one boat in a day. As the toggle cleared the water, she reached back to help him heave the streaming catch over the side. It was a good haul, and she stepped back on the podium to give Otto room to work and to adjust helm and engine to keep the boat on station against wind and wave. "Okay," Otto said as he finished with the trap. She popped the boat in gear to give it a little more steerage way, and he dropped the pot over the side once more. Otto slipped his gloves off and rubbed sweat off his forehead with his wrist, trying to keep the salt water and bait juice out of his eyes while he did it. "I don't know about you," he said, "but I'm ready for lunch." She grinned. "You're always ready for lunch," she teased him. "Well, not always," he protested. "There's dinner and breakfast, too." "And evening snack," she suggested. "Oh, and don't forget the afternoon snack," he added. They had a good chuckle as the boat got up to speed and began planing nicely across the water. The loud engines and the roar of the wind in their ears made it hard to talk, so they lapsed into a comfortable silence. Rachel at the helm, Otto leaning on the bows, his back to the wind, looking over the stern at their spreading wake. Rachel's eyes strayed to the 40-odd boxes of crabs stacked neatly along the far rail. The weight on that side gave the Krabby Patty a bit of a list, but nothing serious. On the grand scheme of things, a metric kiloton of fish, even specialized fish like crabs, wasn't going to make that much difference. Alan was even complaining that it wasn't really enough to process efficiently. She smiled. About half this lot would be getting on the shuttle and going up to the orbital to be used fresh in one of the trendier restaurants up there. The rest would be going to Fairfax, to the Fairfax House. She suspected that once the fad caught on, there'd be a lot of local restaurants wanting a share of the rare catch. She started doing the math in her head again. 2 tons a day times 5 boats would be 10 tons a day. Over the course of a 250-day fishing season, that'd be 2.5 kilotons. Multiplied over the 4,000 fishing villages along the south coast, that would be 10 megatons. Compared to the 1,000 megaton quotas they'd be facing next year, didn't seem like more than a teaspoon against the tide, but every ton of crab was fetching 10 times the revenue of even prime Muda. Rachel made the turn back into the bay, following the channel markers back to the dock. The processing crew was waiting for her with a grab pallet, and she and Otto hefted the boxes up to the waiting hands. A few minutes with a bucket and a mop got the boat ready for the next run, and in a matter of ticks they were walking back to the cottage and lunch. "So, what do you fancy for lunch, then?" she asked the sprouting team. "Crab cakes?" He laughed, voice cracking a little before saying, "I think a little soup and some of that nice sourdough bread, and a nap for dessert." She grinned and didn't argue. It sounded very good indeed, especially the nap. It was only a matter of a few ticks to warm a pot of soup and slice a couple of hunks of bread from the loaf. They settled down to eat. "What do you think of this crabbing business, Otto?" his mother asked him. "That's a lot of crabs, but can it really make a dent in the landings?" She smiled at his thoughts echoing her own. "Well, not just one boat, of course. Yeah, he said, but look at all the tons that come in on the draggers every day. How many boats would it take to match that? A lot, she said, but we're only fishing half a day with 100 traps. If we set our minds to it, we could probably fish 200. True, he admitted, maybe as many as 300 traps. That'd be pushing the limits of the boat if we kept getting that many crabs consistently. Start on the far end and work in, she suggested. That would work, he said, thinking hard about it as he suddenly scraped the bottom of his bowl. The shortest run with the largest load. Well, assume 10 kilograms for 300 traps. That's 3 kilotons a day, she pointed out. A dragger brings in what, 80? He countered. True, but we make more money. Really? He asked. No, not really. But on a price per kilogram, we make 10 times more money. It's just that they can bring in so many more. Keep in mind, though, that we have a smaller, much cheaper boat and gear, and it's only the two of us, not three. You know what else? Otto asked. His mother nodded for him to go on. This is safer. They both thought back to the boxfish, which made them think of Richard. That line of conversation petered out for a few heartbeats. Then Rachel said, I got a message from him last night. They're doing well out there. The crew rotations are working and all that. It was a rather awkward conversation change, but Otto took the offering. He's probably having a ball. Actually, I thought he sounded a little homesick, Rachel said, but didn't add that it was probably just her wishful thinking. They finished lunch and headed to their respective bedrooms to make good on the nap idea. But sleep eluded Otto. Perhaps he slept a bit, but after a time he rose and slipped out to the shed. As he crossed the backyard, he stopped, sniffed the air, and found something in it that made him frown a bit. He continued on and lit the fire in the stove. He gathered some herbs, wintergreen, pennyroyal, foxglove amongst them, wrapped them with a strip of hawthorn bark. A quick slice freed blood from his thumb, and he pattered a few drops like rain on the bark. He pictured his father, and watched the bundle as it caught fire in the stove. Redolent smoke sucked up the chimney and blown south on the offshore breeze. When the bundle was ash, he stirred it with a bit of driftwood and tossed that on the small pyre, stoking the stove until a cheery blaze burned. Smiling to himself, he settled down with a bit of wood to carve. His eye caught the line of a storm petrel in the wood, and he thought it was an auspicious find. He blotted the blood from his thumb with a bit of tissue and then started to free the petrel from the stick. His hands worked by themselves, as his mind was busy elsewhere. Chapter 46, Piranos Seamount, September 27, 2305. Jimmy looked at the clouds. They were building across the horizon to the west, and as the sun passed the zenith and sank into them, the afternoon took on an ominous cast. Well, I guess we'll find out how good our planning was, he said. After the frantic early morning work, unloading fish, loading food, and topping off the fuel and water tanks, the day had oozed along like honey. Richard, standing beside him on the mess deck, nodded but smiled. Looks like I'm going to have a lot to hear today, he said. After a couple of ticks, he asked, Are you sure you want to ride this out with me, Jimmy? Jimmy grinned, No, but I'm here. Seems only right that I be the one with my butt on the line. They're my ideas, and it's kind of late to leave now. He looked at Richard then. Are you sure you won't leave? Richard shrugged and shook his head. Harv and I got things to do. When the boats come back after the storm, the crews will need showers, food, and fuel, he said simply. The draggers had all run off to the south that morning when the weather satellites had started showing the atmospheric instability which had spawned the storm bearing down on them. They took all the crews and staff with them when they went. It was a little crowded in some of the forecastles, but better safe than sorry. Richard and Harv had volunteered to stay with the barges. The barges were all buttoned up as tightly as they could be. The big cables that provided power for the processing plant had been disconnected and rolled up, stored securely in lockers on the power barge. The heavy fuse actor was secured down to standby so that it would be ready to come back online at a moment's notice. Over on the processing barges, all the equipment was shut down, locked down, and generally stowed. The fuel barge was riding a bit high in the water with all the extra fuel they'd pumped out of it, but it had the least deck obstruction and was the least likely to have a problem in a heavy blow. The dormitory had its own power and water supplies and could operate for weeks without replenishment, except for the perishable foodstuffs. All the barges were riding on double anchors, splayed 90 degrees apart off the bows with the dormitory barge farthest west. That wasn't anything new. They set the anchorage up that way on the first day on the mount. Heavy weather was most likely to come from the west, and indeed the prevailing winds came from the west the majority of the time, so they'd oriented their small fleet to take advantage of the prevailing winds. The exception to the double-anchored mooring was a string of 5 empty barges linked together in a train in the easternmost edge of the anchorage. They were the barges that had brought out supplies and were waiting for fish to take back. Another one would join them in a day or two. The tug skipper was hove to about a day north, just down over the horizon from where Jimmy and Richard stood. He'd put out a sea anchor and was battening down for a blow. He didn't want to be too close to the seamount when the ocean started heaving. "Well," Richard said so suddenly that Jimmy almost jumped, "who'd like a nice cup of tea?" Jimmy blinked at him, but Harve Goodwin, the barge's maintenance mechanic, stepped out into the mess deck at that moment. "Oh, I think that sounds lovely," he said. "Shall I put the kettle on?" "No, sit, Harve," Richard said. "I'll do it. Did you get that door seal repaired?" he asked, as he slipped into the galley and ran fresh water into a kettle. "Oh, yeah," Harve said, flopping bonelessly onto one of the settees. "Should be good now. It was just crimped over a bit. A little loving persuasion. My glue gun took care of it." "You didn't glue the door closed, did you?" Richard asked in mock horror. Jimmy chuckled in spite of himself, and Hark chuckled right along with him. By the time they'd gotten the tea brewed and scavenged a few cookies from the larder, the storm cloud had swept across the sky above them. Off to the west, about a half a kilometer, the artificial reef was already paying dividends. Over the course of the summer, every other barge came out loaded with concrete blocks as ballast. Those blocks were dumped in a line west of the anchorage and built up until they formed a low wall about 200 meters long, 50 meters wide at the base, and almost 20 meters above the seamount. There was still 5 meters of water over the top, enough that a fully laden barge or fishing boat could scoot over the top of it. What it did was catch the rollers that came in from the west and forced them to break early, splashing harmlessly on the pile of rocks and dissipating their energy before they got to the barges. The resulting lagoon effect was noticeable even in good weather. With the storm-driven waves beginning to hit, it was beginning to show a lot of splashing white water that glowed in the gathering gloom. The first patterings of rain struck the glass as the wind began building in earnest, and the barge, normally almost perfectly stable, began to take on a significant fore-and-aft pitch. Richard and Harve settled down in a couple of the couches facing the glass and sipped their tea, each lost in their own thoughts. Jimmy stood at the windows for another tick or two, but soon joined them, trying to relax onto the cushions even as the sound of the wind got louder, as it whistled across the glass and around the deckhouse. There wasn't much to say, and each of them didn't say it. Harve seemed totally unperturbed by the rising wind and sea. The rain picked up and began sleeting sideways across the glass as the wind blowing across it overcame the gravity pulling the droplets down. Inside the mess deck, it got darker as the combination of sinking sun and rising storm wrapped them in dimness. A light in the galley splashed across the floor and provided enough light for them to see each other, but their eyes were drawn out to sea. "How strong do you suppose the wind will get?" Harve asked Richard. Richard shrugged. "As strong as it needs to, I suppose," he said. Jimmy thought that was rather an odd answer, but it satisfied Harve, so he didn't question it. Richard reached down and put his mug of tea on the low table in front of him. Jimmy noted that the table was in a lot better shape than he'd expected. He had a sudden flashback of the day he'd hired Richard and remembered thinking that the furniture and fixtures on the barge would take a beating with all the fishermen using it over time. He also remembered the blood on the rail and wondered, hoped really, that whatever blessing Richard had placed on the barge was still in effect. Outside, the wind started ripping the water off the tops of the choppy waves and adding the salt to the fresh rain as it was driven into the front of the deckhouse. Jimmy had to squint to see the foaming breakwater, but it was obviously doing what it was intended to do. The pitch was building, but it was still not enough to do more than tilt the tea a bit in the mug that Richard had placed on the table. Jimmy took comfort in that. So long as they weren't going to be pitched so far forward that the waves were blown over the bow, they were probably in pretty good shape. They sat there in the gloom, eyes adjusting to a dimness relieved only by the light of the galley behind them and the foaming surge outside. The rain was blowing in horizontal sheets that would periodically obscure even the gleaming breakwater. Every tick that went by, the wind's howl rose in pitch until what had started out as a growl was transferred into a banshee's wail in the dark night. Jimmy looked at his chrono and was surprised to see that he'd been sitting there for over 3 stands, just watching the storm and sitting silently. With an awareness of time came an awareness of his body and how much he needed to use the head. When he moved, the other two looked at him, and he smiled at them in the dimness. He pointed in the direction of the head, not even trying to speak over the water pounding against the glass and the shrieking wind. The deck was remarkably stable, given the weather outside. The breakwater continued to stop large waves from rolling across the seamount surface. He re-zipped and was just beginning to feel more than physical relief when the deck pitched up underneath him. It wasn't a lot of pitch, but it was a lot more all at once, and that made him nervous. He hurried back to find Richard catching his mug before it slid off the table, and he found the walking to be much more difficult with the deck tossing beneath his feet. The wind seemed to abate a bit, or at least the screaming went down a notch in pitch, and he staggered back to the couch. The furniture, he knew, was cleated to the deck. It could be released for cleaning, but it was securely clamped to the deck, and Jimmy was grateful for the support as the pitching became more pronounced. Jimmy glanced at Harve and was shocked to see him curled up on the sofa, apparently asleep. When he looked back, Richard was grinning at him. His eyes and teeth glowed whitely in the reflected light from the galley. Jimmy jerked a thumb in Harve's direction as if to say, "What's with him?" Richard just grinned wider, and the barge began to pitch more and more. Jimmy squinted out of the forward glass and realized he couldn't see the white foam of the breakwater. The relentless pounding had shifted enough of the blocks that it was no longer blocking the waves as effectively as it used to. They weren't rolling over the blocks anymore, and the energy of the huge rollers was getting amplified as they rolled onto the relatively shallow seamount. As the up-and-down movement became more and more violent, Jimmy began to wonder if they might not actually crack the hull against the only rock around, the one 25 meters underneath them. As the thought came to him, he knew it was foolish. While 25 meters wasn't a lot on the scale of the sea, it was still a huge amount when measuring waves. He wondered what else he should be concerned about instead when he saw something large and dark moving on the water outside the portside glass. No, it wasn't moving. They were. It was the power barge, and they were being blown backwards, dragging the massive blocks along the bottom as the wind caught on the deckhouse and under the bows each time the barge pitched up. Jimmy glanced over at Richard, who seemed to be considering something. Jimmy moved over to the couch to sit next to Richard. "We're dragging anchor," he shouted, to be heard over the racketing storm. Richard nodded his understanding. "Waves broke the wall. Each upswell tugs the anchors a bit more," he yelled back. "They're sliding on the mud." Jimmy kicked himself then for overlooking one last obvious problem. On the relatively smooth surface of the basalt plug, slime and mud buildup provided an effective lubricant for the large block anchors they'd set down to moor the barges to. "If we slide far enough, the blocks will fall off the mount, and we'll be floating free in the wind," he shouted. Richard seemed to consider that. So did Jimmy. Worst case, the anchors would be too heavy for the barge to support, and would pull the bows down far enough to ship water straight up the length of the barge. Best case, they'd be blown westward until the storm blew itself out, leaving them who knew where. They had a couple of kilometers before either one happened, but the storm was moving them pretty fast. Jimmy saw Richard's eyes flick out to the dark shape to port, and then swing to starboard, where Jimmy could just make out the low-slung fuel barge riding securely at anchor. Richard frowned at that, and reached into his shirt to pull out the small figure hung around his neck on a leather thong. He lifted it to his lips, and gave it a kiss before dropping it to his chest. Jimmy thought it looked like some kind of sheep, but he wasn't familiar enough to identify what kind. Richard stood then and walked to the front of the mess deck, stopping just before he got to the glass. He stood there for a long moment, not moving. Then Jimmy noticed that his arms were locked straight down by his sides, with his hands balled into fists. Richard's head bowed, and he seemed to be rooted in the pitching deck. Up and down he rode, as stable as if he were part of the barge, bolted down like the furniture. The wind picked up to a high-pitched scree, and still Richard stood there, arms locked to his sides, hands and fists as if he were holding on for dear life. Jimmy had no idea what he thought he was doing, and the pitching didn't seem to be letting up a lot. Richard just stood there, and Jimmy got more and more worried with every tick. It wasn't until almost a half a stand later that Jimmy focused enough to realize that the power barge was still in the same relative position outside the portside glass. Either the anchors had fetched up on something in the bottom, or the power barge was being blown back at the same rate. Jimmy leaned forward to see that the fuel barge was also still where it had been when Richard went up to the bow and started his "I'm bolted down" act. Except Jimmy knew it wasn't an act. He thought he caught a faint scent of wood smoke. It was gone as soon as he was aware of it, a wisp in the breeze. The hairs on his arms stood up. For the next stand, Jimmy sat rooted on the couch. The sound of the wind rose in pitch even more and kept blowing. Jimmy marveled at Harve's ability to sleep through it and glanced over to where he lay, curled up on the other sofa, even as the barge lifted, tilting back against each wave front, hovered at the crest for a breathless heartbeat, and then tilted forward again, sliding down to plash into the trough at the bottom, and digging into the foot of the next one, the wave breaking on the blunt prow and slamming the glass only a meter in front of Richard's face, before rising with a shudder to repeat the cycle again and again and again. Harsh just lay there, rolling back against the cushions as they pitched up, shifting only slightly forward as they pitched down, his curled legs keeping him from rolling forward right off the couch. Jimmy tried to peer out of the windows, but it was very dark outside by then. The waves were dim mountains sliding by in the night, when they weren't breaking against the glass. As the hammering continued, Jimmy began to wonder if the framework would hold. He was pretty sure the glass was solid, but he couldn't help thinking about what would happen if one of the huge panes slammed through the frame under the weight of the heavy green water that was battering the bow each time they bottom out in the trough of a wave. For another stand, nothing else happened. Wave after wave. The screaming wind. Harve sleeping soundly on the other couch. Richard rooted on the deck, unmoving, not even lifting his head to look at the waves as they crashed at him. Jimmy's fear slowly melted as the stand wore on. The barge seemed to be holding together against the pounding. He couldn't be sure if the barge was still drifting backwards or not because they couldn't see anything beyond the dark glass anymore, except for an occasional flash of swirling green water as it sluiced off the bows and around the sides of the deckhouse. Harve slept on. Two tense, exhausting stands later, the storm blew over, almost as suddenly as it came. Jimmy noticed the change in the sounds first. The wind's scream seemed a little less intense. Even as they continued the roller coaster ride up one side and smashing down on the other, the screech reduced and pitched until, after only a few dozen waves, it was down to a moan. The waves, without the wind behind them, lost some of their urgency. It was another stand before the cloud deck broke enough to let Jimmy see the night sky through the glass. And by then, the bow of the barge stopped digging into the following waves, and the violence of the up-and-down movement subsided. Harve, impossibly, woke then and sat up, yawning and stretching, scratching behind his ear and blinking blearily at Jimmy and Richard, and finally out at the heaving sea beyond. He nodded as if to himself and rose, a bit unsteadily on the pitching deck, and went into the galley. Jimmy felt suddenly like he was in some odd play, a kind of movie where he was the only one who could see the danger all around, and everybody else was walking in some other reality. The wind had died enough by then that Jimmy could hear the sharp metal clinking of the kettle going onto the burner, and a few ticks later the sound of a spoon against a heavy china mug. The high clinking cut through the moaning of the wind in a way that voices probably wouldn't. In a few moments Harve returned with three mugs of tea, the pungent aroma of the leaf, smelling of land, cut with a bit of sweet honey. Wordlessly, Harve handed a mug to Jimmy. Jimmy had to uncramp his fingers from where he'd been clutching the cushions under him, and it took a moment or two for him to get enough feeling back in them to be able to reliably take the mug. Harve waited patiently, a faint grin on his face, swaying on the deck to keep his balance against the pitch. Jimmy got his hands wrapped around the mug, and the shocking warmth of the heavy ceramic made him realize how cold it was on the mess deck. The temperature had dropped, but in the literal heat of his terror, he hadn't noticed. With only two mugs to balance, Harve made his way to where Richard was standing and held out a mug to him. As Jimmy watched, Richard returned from wherever he was. It was as if the shape of Richard had been some kind of statue, a fitting on the deck like a cleat or a bollard, and no more live. In the next heartbeat he was there, reaching for the hot mug. Suddenly not merely there and alive, but somehow more than there. Richard took the mug with a grateful smile to Harve and sipped the hot, sweet tea, warming his hands on the glass and his face in the steam. Jimmy could see Richard look up and out across the sea, scanning from left to right slowly and then back again. Harve stood with him, not speaking, although the howl of the wind had reduced enough that they might be able to hear each other speak. Richard seemed satisfied with whatever his survey had revealed to him, and he turned to walk back to the couch, Harve trailing like a collie at heel. Richard plopped down on the couch next to Jimmy, and Harve returned to a station across from them. Richard sat heavily, and Jimmy could see the exhaustion written across the man's frame and the way he leaned over his tea and in the lines around his eyes. Outside, the wind's racketing continued to die down, and the up-and-down pitching had smoothed to something more like large rollers. Jimmy wasn't sure when the rain had stopped, but he noted it only as a hole in the cacophony as it all faded down to something akin to normal. Glancing at Richard out of the corner of his eye, Jimmy wondered what normal might really consist of. Richard sipped his tea and smiled. "I think we're okay now," he said, a bit hoarsely, his voice louder than Jimmy expected against the background of the fading storm. Jimmy sipped his own tea and didn't answer. After that, he wasn't sure that he could answer. Harve suggested, "Mr. Krug, you look like you could use some sleep. The boats will be back in the morning, and you'll want to be ready for them." Richard blinked, settling himself a bit more in reality, and nodded into his mug. "That's a good idea, Harve," he said distantly. "I think I'll get some sleep." He stood and walked down the hall toward the bunk room, stopping at the galley to drop off his cup. Jimmy just watched him, still too drained to move, still too stunned by the experience. He noticed Harve observing him. He opened his mouth to say one thing, but "How could you sleep through that?" came out. Harve chuckled. "Why not? It was just a little storm." "We could have died," Jimmy said. "Yeah? Well, how would my being awake have helped?" Harve asked, his grin not fading. Jimmy chuckled at that. "I guess it wouldn't have, but between the noise and the thrashing around, I couldn't have done it," he said. Harve shrugged. "Mr. Krug was on the job," he said simply, as if that answered everything. The more Jimmy thought about it, maybe it did. "Why don't you get some sleep too, Mr. P?" he suggested. "I'll keep watch." His eyes gleamed on the faint light from the galley. Jimmy looked out across the calming ocean. The starlight was enough to illuminate the rolling surface. The power barge was missing from the view to port, and he wondered idly, almost numbly, where it could be. He hoped it wasn't on the seamount. The fuel barge was still there where he'd seen it last, more or less. He couldn't be sure. His eyes burned, though, and the adrenaline was washing out of his bloodstream, leaving a bit sick in his stomach. He nodded at Harve. "That's a good idea, Harve. Thanks." "Sleep well, Mr. P," he replied. "Sleep well." Jimmy crawled into a bunk and dreamed an odd dream of fleecy storm clouds being butted by some kind of ram with black horns and huge shoulders. The ram was standing, guarding something. One of those nebulous dream somethings that you know are there but you can't quite see. The fleecy cloud would come close and the ram would lunge once and butt it with its curved black horns. It didn't disappear exactly, but it was broken up, its power diffused. But storm clouds weren't fleecy, they were black or gray as iron, but these clouds didn't seem to mind being fleecy white. They just kept coming, and the ram kept butting until a bang on the hull woke him with a start. There was sun coming in and light. He heard voices down the passage and could smell bacon and eggs and coffee. He clambered out of the tangled sheets, stopped at the head to do the needful, and rinse his face, slicking back his bed-tossed hair with wet hands. A couple of the boats were moored alongside the dormitory barge, and their crews were enjoying a hot meal, courtesy of Harve's talent in the galley. When Harve saw Jimmy emerge, he waved a spatula in a friendly salute and offered a plate. Jimmy shook his head. "Not just yet, Harve, thanks. I need to wake up a bit." He pulled a mug from the rack and helped himself to coffee from the big urn bolted to the counter. The dragger crews were comparing notes on the long voyage to the south and back on boisterous voices. He wasn't tracking too well yet, but they were in high spirits and anxious to get back to work. Jimmy's pita vibrated, and he pulled that out of his pocket. It was a message from Tony. He grunted. "Good news, crews," he announced. "We're on track to make quarter with next week's landings, and we got a month left to go." They stopped briefly to listen, and then cheer. "That is good news, Mr. P," Harve said from the galley. "Will we be packing up here, then?" Jimmy considered that. He still didn't know what happened to the other barges in the fleet, nor the fates of the other draggers. "Depends, Harve. I need to see what we got left." He stepped up to the glass on the port side and looked to the south. He could see more of the boats heading in from the horizon, but there was nothing where he'd last seen the power barge. He stepped out of the door to the port side and found Richard standing there looking aft. Jimmy went to join him and looked back to where he was staring. Off in the distance to the east, he saw the power barge, and beyond it a couple of shapes that he didn't quite recognize until his eyes adjusted to the morning light. Apparently, the empty barges had taken on enough water to almost submerge. They'd be salvageable with a little pump work. The processing plant barges were missing, though, and Jimmy walked aft to stand in the after rail to get a good view of the eastern horizon. "They're gone," Richard said behind him. "Sunk?" Jimmy asked before he could stop himself. Richard chuckled. "I don't think so, but I think they got blown off the mount. We'll need to check the finder, and I suspect you'll find him a couple hundred kilometers off in that direction." He pointed off to the east. "A couple of the draggers should be able to bring him in. We'll be back online in a day or so." They stood there, looking at the open ocean, not talking. The protection of the breakwater was gone, and the rollers were rocking the barge more than before, but it wasn't problematic. "We're going to make the landing quarters," Jimmy said. Richard smiled. "Yes," he said. "I've been following them on the net. We'll be in bonus territory by the time we pack up and tow this all in." Jimmy sipped his coffee and smelled the fresh morning air. In the end, he had to ask, "What did you do last night?" Richard turned and looked at Jimmy. A smile, tired, but filled with amusement and even wonder, slowly grew across his face. "I just listened to the world," he said. Chapter 47, Calum's Cove, December 4, 2305. Otto leaned down and picked up a bit of shell. He held it to the light and then showed it to his father. "Look at how purple that is," he said. Richard leaned over to look at it. "Oh, that's a really good piece," he agreed. Otto slipped it into his gather bag and pulled his mitten back on. As he straightened up, they continued their stroll down the half-frozen, windswept sand. "Father," he asked, "when did you realize you were a shaman?" They walked along a while before his father answered. Otto knew it wasn't a simple question, and he waited patiently for the answer. "Well," he said, after they'd walked a good 10 meters down the beach, "when your grandfather died, I was automatically the shaman." "Son of the shaman is the shaman," Otto said, stooping to pick up a bit of wood that proved to be just a bit of wood. "Yes," he said, his poncho flapping in the wind, kicking at a pile of driftwood to see if there were any smaller bits in it that were interesting. They walked a bit further. Richard glanced at Otto. "When did you realize I was a shaman?" he asked. Otto grinned. "When they were flying you in from the boat," he said without hesitation. "That boxfish did something to you." Richard laughed. "Well, yes, it almost killed me." "Yes," Otto said with a smile, "there is that." And they walked on down the beach, the morning sun climbing higher in the sky, a bitter southwest wind blowing in off the water. Richard asked, "So when did you realize you were a shaman?" Otto thought back, tracing the thread of time like a scent of smoke in the wind, back through the fall, before the Krabby Patty. "I think it was when I saw one of your carvings and threw up," he said. Richard barked a laugh into the wind. "Yes, well, I haven't carved the head off from anything lately, have I?" he asked. Otto chuckled and reached down to pick up a nice bit of driftwood that looked like it had something in it, but he couldn't quite see it. He brushed it off, held it up, shook his head and slipped it into the bag in his back. "No, Father, not in a long time," he said at last. After a few more meters, Otto asked, "Were you scared?" Richard stopped then and thought. "No," he said. "I should have been, but no." Otto digested that for a time before asking, "But you could have died out there. They say you saved the dorm barge with magic, you know." Pausing to pry a chunk of driftwood up out of the sand, brush it off, and slip it into his own bag, Richard replied, "Yes, they say that." He walked a few steps on down the beach before adding, "And I could have died, but it didn't matter." "Why did you go?" Otto asked a while later. "It was where I was supposed to be," Richard said. "I don't know how I know, but..." He shrugged. "Did you save the barge through magic?" Otto asked. Richard paused in his walking to consider that seriously. "I don't know," he said. "I went out there to listen to the world. We were out there almost all summer long, right through the end of the fall season. I got a lot of chance out there to listen." "Yeah," Otto said, "I keep listening, but I'm not sure what I'm hearing," he confessed. Richard chuckled and nodded sympathetically. "You know, your grandfather and I used to walk this beach, and he'd try to tell me what it meant to be a shaman. I always got so frustrated when he'd never say what it is that shamans do." It was Otto's turn to chuckle and nod. "I think I can relate to that myself," he said. They'd reached the arc of stones. Each sat on a rock to rest a bit and decide whether they wanted to keep going or turn back. "So what did you do out there that night?" Otto asked. Richard looked out to sea, his eyes all the way to the horizon, as if he could see over it and even back in time. He shrugged one shoulder a little. "I just listened to the world," he said at last. Otto nodded as if that were enough explanation. They stood up and stretched a little, looking speculatively down the beach, but coming to the unspoken agreement that a cup of hot tea was a better idea than more cold walking down the beach. "Something else happened that night, though, didn't it?" Otto asked, as they started the long trudge back to the cottage and Rachel and hot tea. Richard's face took on an unexpected light as he remembered back. He looked over at his son, striding along the beach with his staff, plucking shell and wood from the sand. He looked beyond him and out to where the sea was plashing on the smooth sand shore, and beyond it still to the crystalline horizon, a shimmer in the frozen sunlight. "Yes," he admitted, and looked down to where Otto looked up at him expectantly. "I heard it," Richard said. Otto grinned broadly. Together they turned to continue their hike back home. Otto's staff rattled in the wind off the water, and Richard's embroidered red poncho flapped a counterpoint. Occasionally, one or the other would stoop and pick up a bit of something from the sand. Sometimes one would show the other. Sometimes they'd just slip it in the bag, or toss it aside to wait for the next tide. They were in no hurry, with nothing more important to do than listen to the world. Thank you for listening to South Coast, a shaman's tale from the golden age of the solar clipper. Music is from Wish by Rafael Garcia Perdigón. Available on the Internet Archive at www.archive.org. This has been a presentation from Durandus, offered under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 2.5 license. For a website and more information on the Golden Age, visit www.durandus.org/golden.